I am Gillian Strain, and welcome to the Go Health podcast. So we're in season 3 of the podcast, where we are exploring this topic, Together We Flourish. And this is a special episode for the Easter season 2023. So often after we get to Easter Sunday, we go back to normal really quickly in the church. You know, after the Easter eggs and the lamb and the celebrations are all over, we sometimes very quickly return to ordinary life in the church. And sometimes this means that we've missed the opportunity to keep journeying deeper as we've journeyed through Holy Week into the profound mystery of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. In this episode, we've looked back over all the previous editions of the Go Health podcast to bring you a compilation, a constellation of snippets of wisdom on the meaning of the resurrection from all sorts of wonderful people. People who have faced ill health or chronic conditions, from those people who have senior leadership positions, and from those who, like all of us, are attempting to live in the reality of a world full of suffering, but to do so with faith, with faithful hearts inspired by the power of Easter. So in this episode, you will hear from Bishop Jan McFarlane on finding the resurrection hope in her cancer journey. From Dr. Paula Gooder on the meaning of the body, our bodies, and the resurrection. From Claire Gilbert, who lives with terminal cancer. From Bishop Adrian Newman on encountering the risen Christ. And from the very Reverend Martin Fair on the radical resurrection and the need for its radicalness today. I think that's a word. So this is our Easter gift to you. And it's also an invitation to join us, join our community, if you want to keep exploring how to live healthy, flourishing lives, inspired by that faith begun by the risen Jesus. Our vision in the Guild of Health and St. Raphael is to see flourishing communities made up of flourishing individuals. That's you and me. And the Go Health community is a place of faith, of sharing, of learning and practice, where we actively tend to our own journey towards health and well-being. Please go to the website to find out more, and you'll also find information in the show notes. And thank you for your interest in the work of the Guild of Health and St. Raphael. May the risen Christ bless you this Easter time.
So at the Go Health podcast, one of the things that we're really interested in is people's stories. Mm-hmm. And actually, the idea from this podcast came out of working with my team, Wendy and Graham, as we'd often just share our stories and then tell about other stories we've heard. And my own experience of having cancer, my experience of being, when I told my story, I felt a sense of healing. Mm-hmm. And it elicited other people to tell their story.
Yeah.
As well. And stories, are important. You've got those headline kind of things about our careers, of who we are, what it says on our CV. But actually what we're super interested in is the story behind the CV. The stories that make us who we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly through suffering, we're made to question who we are and how we live. Yeah. You've had an experience of breast cancer.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could share your story with us. Mm. I mean, I don't know where to start. Do we start with diagnoses?
Yeah. I mean, I was one of those people who was in and out of the breast clinic for years and years, really, yeah. Because I had what they beautifully describe as lumpy breasts.
Right. Which is kind of
gorgeous. Thanks. and so this was just like another day at the office, you know, back in for another check. My GP hadn't thought there was really a problem, but why not just go and get it checked? So I was kind of so relaxed about it. And, you know, virtually as they were doing the ultrasound and so on, I was kind of on my iPad answering emails. You know, I was that laid back. That sure.
And at this stage, were you Archdeacon or Bishop?
I was archdeacon at this stage, yeah. And also the communications director, and that's significant to the rest of the story. And so I wasn't told in a great way, because the radiographer just said, I don't like what I'm seeing here. So I said, yeah. And he said, he basically just said, I need you to go for a biopsy, but even if the biopsy is clear, I'd send you for another biopsy because I'm convinced it's cancer. That's just really not the way to be told. No. And my husband was away in France. I don't think I'd even told him I was going to the hospital, you know, because I was so laid back about it. And so that was incredibly difficult because I think whenever anybody's given that diagnosis of cancer, the shock of it is so massive. I think had I had a week where I'd been told, oh, I'm not sure about this, go for a biopsy and then we'll see what it's like in a week's time, it would have been time for me to think, oh, gosh, maybe this is. But I hadn't really thought about it at all. Mm. And I think often of the advertisements, I think it's Macmillan Cancer Care, where they show somebody kind of just walking along and then suddenly that person just freezes and everybody else catches them. Mm. And I thought about that quite often because that is how it felt. Suddenly your world comes to this grinding halt. And there was a sense of, but that doesn't happen to me. Cancer is something that happens to everybody else. Why do you think that? You know, it's a really silly thing to think, but I guess we all think that deep down it happens to somebody else. And I remember sitting in front of the doctor because I refused to leave the hospital until I'd seen the doctor again. And just said, but I can't have cancer because I've got all these plans. And, you know, and if you're saying the treatment's going to be a year, well, I can't because it's going to be my 50th birthday and we're going to do this and it's my 10th wedding anniversary and we're going to do that. And it's the vote for the ordination of women to be bishops and I'm not missing that, and, you know. And then kind of gently trying to say, yeah, but actually if you don't have this treatment, you know. So it was a real, I remember sitting in front of the television for days and days afterwards, and I wasn't watching the television. My head was going, I've got breast cancer, and I couldn't take it in. But what I did learn was that you kind of get onto this amazing conveyor belt. Mm. The hospital's just dealing with this day in, day out. Mm. So for you, it's this life-changing moment. For them, it's just another person who's got cancer.
And to what extent is that a useful thing?
I thought it was great, actually. Yeah, because I felt in very, very safe hands. I thought, do you know, they know what they're doing.
Yes.
And what I've got to do is just cooperate with them and take their advice. And if they say I need a particular treatment, I need it, and get on with it.
And in that silence, that kind of, I'm not watching the TV, what do you think was going on for you subconsciously? What was happening in that time just before you started treatment?
I think it was just trying to come to terms with that diagnosis. It was shock. It was having to reevaluate this very busy life. This person who was always very busy, important, you know, doing all this important stuff, and invincible.
Mm.
And suddenly, no, actually, you're not invincible at all. And actually, there will be other people who cover your job for you while you're having treatment. So, you know, you're not indispensable. And actually, you might not live. It was a bit like a bereavement in a way. You know, the kind of, my image of me as this very competent, very well, very healthy person who does things for other people had to suddenly change. Suddenly I'm this person who has to have things done to them.
Mm.
There's got to be a patient, which I'm not, and other people are going to do my job, you know. So your whole kind of self-image, I think, kind of dissolves in front of your eyes. You know, you've got to become this different person that you didn't expect to ever have to be, alongside facing your own mortality, because, of course, at that stage you don't know what the long-term prognosis is going to be, and having to face what isn't the most pleasant of treatment.
Mm.
And with all the sort of, I suppose, fear, I suppose, that goes alongside that. And yet at the same time, confiding in close colleagues, not being able to confide in my family at that stage because I didn't know what the prognosis was and it didn't seem fair to say to my parents, I've got cancer, but I don't know what that means. So just confiding in very close colleagues and my husband. And just feeling so supported by prayer.
Mm. And how long was the gap between to that day at the hospital when you got a bit of a shock and the world changed, and then some time to try to pick up what it means. So how long was it until you got the official diagnosis?
I'm really struggling to remember that because I think the world went into a bit of a blur at that stage. And I know they did a biopsy, but I think they were already sure that they were dealing with cancer. And so they'd done a mammogram and so on. So I think I went back a week later, and I remember walking in to see the consultant, and the breast care nurse was there. And at that point, I kind of thought, oh, okay, you know, this is... So the poor breast care nurse, I wasn't very nice to her, really, because somebody has described it as she looked like the executioner, you know, and it did feel a little bit like that, like this is really serious now.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to the consultant, look, I can cope with anything so long as I know you're telling me everything.
Yeah.
So I just want to know everything. And she was absolutely brilliant. Yeah. But they have to then work out, it was a very big cancer, which had kind of grown without anybody spotting it. And therefore they needed to know how it spread. So there were then further MRI scans and tests. And then they came out and said, there's something on your liver and we don't know what it is. And I said, so what's the implications of that? And they said, well, we need to do more tests on your liver. I'd said to her, be honest, and she said, and if the tests on your liver are positive, we won't bother doing the mastectomies. So I said, why? And she said, well, because it kind of won't be worth it. So I remember turning around and saying to her, you will do the mastectomy. She said, I just knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
And they just needed to check, and it turned out it hadn't spread further. But there was a week waiting for the results of the scan on the liver.
Mm.
I'm waiting for the phone call to come to say whether that was just the very worst time of all of it.
Because
that was make or break, really.
Yeah. And can you remember what helped in that period of profound sort of liminality and waiting? And
I'm a very strong introvert, so I tend to kind of hold stuff in and process it internally rather than kind of go bleh, you know, and need to involve lots of other people. So again, I talked a lot to very close colleagues. I'd told family by then. Journaling, writing it all down, how am I feeling about this? But just needing space, you know, work-wise, I just went underground, so I was still working, and I could do anything as long as I didn't have to interact with people, really, so I was right on the computer, because I just needed that headspace just to be coming to terms with it. And holding on to, so what does it mean to be a priest who stands at funerals and who talks about the hope of life beyond death and resurrection and so on? You know, what does that suddenly mean to me when I'm faced with my own mortality? And I felt like two people, because there was the me who was very human, very scared. I remember saying to somebody, I'm not actually frightened of dying, because I do wholeheartedly believe that when we die, we go home to be with God. But it's too soon, and I feel a bit like a kid who's playing out on a sunny evening and your mum's shouting you to come in and go to bed while all the other kids are going out playing. It's not that you don't want to go home. It's not that you don't want to go to bed. It's not that you don't want a big hug from your mum, but you just don't want to do it just yet.
Yeah.
And that's how it felt, really. Yeah. It's kind of, okay, you know, we're all going to die, but it just feels a bit soon. I'm 50.
Yeah.
I don't want to die just yet. And there's too much more that I want to do. One of the most profound things, I think, was sharing the news with my immediate colleagues at the beginning of the staff meeting. And bless them, they were all men, so they didn't quite know. So they were all a little squeamish about that. But they just rallied around and were superb. They prayed for me and anointed me with oil. And I'm not, I've never really been a very sacramental Christian. You know, I've never bothered much really with things like oil for healing and things like that. And if I've been really honest, I think I let them do it because they wanted to do it.
Interesting, yeah.
Which was a big thing for me to be ministered to. Mm. But actually, they prayed for me for healing. Healing in the widest sense, you know, death is the ultimate healing.
Mm.
But as it was the Bishop of Thetford, and as he made the sign of the cross on my forehead and on my hands. I was just overwhelmed with the most incredible sense of being prayed for and held by the church, not just those Christians who were gathered around me, but by the church throughout the centuries. Because, you know, it's in the Bible about praying for one another when you're sick and anointing one another. And it was like, do you know, people have done this for 2,000 years. So it was as if the church through the centuries was praying for me, and as if the church across the world was also, you know, suddenly feeling part of this massive Christian community, past and present and worldwide, and being held, you know, by them through the medium of this symbolic oil. It was really, really profound. And I remember for the rest of the day feeling almost as if where I'd been anointed, it was almost burning.
Wow.
It was almost burning. It was tingling and almost burning.
Okay.
And at that point, combined with Ash Wednesday, the beginning of Lent being kind of the next day, and, you know, going into the cathedral, and, you know, you have the ashes put on your forehead.
Thou art dust.
Remember, you are dust. Yeah. And to dust you return.
Gosh.
And that was like, yeah, you know, okay. So this kind of weird mix of being very human and on one level, oh, do you know, I just don't want to die just yet. And at the other level, this really sense of calm of, do you know, it will be okay no matter what.
Mm.
Even if I die, it will be okay.
Mm.
Which I think just kept me going.
Gosh, it's an amazing story.
And with the, you mentioned right at the beginning of our conversation, the sort of Paschal narrative of diagnosis and treatment and the condition you now live in, alongside sort of the Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and the resurrection. Do you see your stem cells bit as the Holy Saturday bit, or are you feeling this is, well, you're just seeing we're an extended Holy Saturday, and we've moments of resurrection when you meet all the hairdresser, or, you know, you get a good email, you know, in what sense are you still living that? Or is it more that, you know, you just discovered that, you know, it is through that Holy Saturday experience that you find God?
Yes, and the resurrection comes again and again and again. So it comes every... So I have my treatment on Wednesday. Thursday is awful. On Friday morning, I wake up and I feel the wellness stealing back into my cells. And it's like a resurrection. It's like I've been through a Good Friday, Holy Saturday resurrection each time I have the chemotherapy. And certainly after the stem cell transplant, as the stem cells started to do their work, the new stem cells... that was like a resurrection, but I'm no, in a sense, I am still in Holy Saturday, and that's why it feels so hard, because it's, you know, one is plodging through, and I'm nervous, Gillian, about the 14th of July, which hopefully will be the last day of my treatment, because I've waited for this day for so long, and yet this cancer doesn't go away, you know, and I can't be too excited. I think everybody who comes out of chemotherapy and treatment must feel this. You have to somehow you dare to hope, but the hope is it is the cost of the hope too much, because the pain of it coming back and the hopes being dashed, and the way cancer can play with you like a cat plays with a mouse, and not wanting that, but also not wanting to deny the life that's rising up in me, and the looked for joy and relief of well, it'd be the 16th of July, I suppose, when I feel better after that last infusion. It's very hard. It's very hard. And there's a dynamic about it. And I think this is, again, the crucifixion, resurrection dynamic because part of me thinks, well, let's just accept the mortality and kind of go to sleep under it and make one's peace with it. But it's not what happens. And I felt that in my body, physically, in the isolation room, that life wants to live, and it grows in you, and you see it in the spring, and it, you can't deny it, and you wouldn't want to deny it. But the cost of that is that it will also die.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's always a place of tension, isn't it? But our whole, you know, it's sort of like you've got the whole life, but in a very focused way.
We often think about living as though we ought to be living perfectly. You know, our goal is to be perfect. Our bodies are perfect. Our spirits are perfect. Our prayer life is perfect. Everything is perfect. And we forget the really important strand that runs through the Bible, which is that governed by the first few chapters of Genesis, we don't live in Eden anymore. Mm. Eden was the place that that was perfect. People would live forever. They didn't need clothes because they didn't get cold. There were perfect relationships with God. God would come and have a natter with them in the evening. I mean, it was all kind of, everything was set up to be perfect. And then we left Eden. And for me, the really important thing is reminding myself time and time again, I no longer live in Eden. Mm. And therefore, I can no longer expect perfection. Actually, my expectation must be of imperfection. Mm. So we live in a creation which is fundamentally flawed. And that, for me, is what the Eden stories are about, mm. about reminding us that we live in a world that has cracks and flaws in it. And we need to adjust our expectations away from if only I was in Eden to I live in a world in which there are cracks and flaws. And in a world where there are cracks and flaws, things will go wrong. There will be natural disasters. There will be physical disasters. You know, the cancer is a manifestation, I think, of a crack and flaw of creation. Mm. There will be relationship disasters. That is the reality of the life in which we live. And what Paul then comes in and says is that with the death and resurrection of Jesus, a new reality comes and lays on top of the old reality. So the new reality is of new creation, where we are. So his vision is that come the end of all time, we will return to a moment in which everything is perfect again. There will be harmony between heaven and earth. You won't need a sun because the sun from God will be shining on us. There will be harmony. There will be wholeness. There will be peace. And what Paul is talking about is with Jesus' death and resurrection, the new creation lies with the old creation. So from time to time, you will see moments of perfection. You will see the moments of resurrection. And those are the moments that keep us going in the difficult time. Mm. But the really important thing for Paul is we still live in old creation. Mm. So although you've got new creation lying on top, you've still got old creation lying underneath. So if you want to ask the question of why is the world as awful as it is, it's because we're living in old creation. Why can I see glimpses of hope and future? It's because we've got new creation laying on top, but the two are functioning side by side until we get to the end of all time. And it's a bit of complex theology, but I find it's the most helpful theology of all to go, well, why do things go wrong? Yeah. You know, and it's across the board, why do things go wrong? You know, I tried in that particular situation to be the best person that I could and be in a really great relationship with so-and-so, but it went wrong. Why did it go wrong? Well, because we're living in a cracked and flawed world. Why did your body suddenly decide to turn on itself? Because we live in a cracked and flawed world and not Eden. And I just find it a really, really helpful explanation to say, it gives you an explanation of why things are as they are. Mm. It also gives you an explanation of the hope that you can look for, that there are moments. There are moments when resurrection happens. There are moments. And that's the healing stuff, to return kind of full circle to the healing. There are a few moments when healing does happen. It doesn't mean it always will. It doesn't mean that you won't ever need it because everything will be perfect. But there will be a few moments when resurrection kind of breaks through.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, there's an amazing quotation. It's Maltman, I think. He defines health as the power to live and the power to die, which I just think, wow, that's it. Because the problem with that magazine rack, and there's nothing wrong with plant-based diet or any exercise, of course, is that the health industry never mentions death. And the medical system is, you know, largely based on avoiding it at all costs. So it's like this massive elephant in the room anytime most people talk about health. And it's the massive elephant that the church and the faith in Jesus Christ can address.
It sort of is back to the Canterbury Cross. It's the death and resurrection being held together,
yeah.
Needing to be able to cope with both of those. I do a little bit of leading of services and preaching still when I'm asked to around here. And I was asked to do Easter and this year, and I was preaching on the stone rolled away from the tomb, and making the point that, well, why was the stone rolled away from the tomb? Well, there was absolutely no reason from Jesus' point of view for it to be rolled away from the tomb. It's pretty clear that after his resurrection, he can move through walls and doors and, you know, teletransport across all sorts of distances. So he didn't need the stone to be moved to get out of the tomb. So it must have been moved for our benefit, for us to look in, because we are being called to look in and to realize that the tomb is empty, and then to go out and live the rest of our lives in that full recognition that we live as people of resurrection in a world where resurrection is a reality. And so I think there is something very significant about that in terms of how we think about our lives.
Yeah. I've never thought about why the stone was rolled away. So you've just written my next Easter sermon and everyone listening. Brilliant. I never thought about it. That's so wonderful about the Gospels and the Bible. You can go back and see something new every single time.
Two and a half years ago, a young man took his life in our community, and it was tragic. He went missing for about 4 days, I think, before he was found, and he was 21. All the young folks in our town were out searching, you know, looking for him. He wasn't found. Eventually, he was found by a police search team. My own boys were involved. He was ages with them. He was friends with them. It was absolutely tragic in a small-ish town, rippled right across. And when I heard he'd been found dead, I mean, I literally just, spur of the moment, I went on Facebook, our local Facebook pages, and just said, St. Andrew's Church is going to be open tonight from 6 o'clock. If anybody wants to just come in. That's all. That's all we did. And that night, Gillian, upwards of 300 young people came into the church. I mean, I can't tell you when that might have ever happened before. Probably not. It was packed with just young people, and me and, you know, my people, we just mixed and mingled with them, but we didn't interfere almost. We just made the space. But many did want to come up and speak. So this business of creating a space where people can come into, even, you know, with no particular religious baggage or language at all, but, and yet still people somehow seem drawn to, you know, to church buildings. And to do that right now will be really important. But also to articulate, I think, when there is an apt opportunity, what I was saying earlier. Yesterday, one of the songs we sang had a line in it, kingdoms rise and fall. And that's true. And over 1,000 years, kingdoms have come and gone, particular reigns, and now this one has come to an end. And all of that is the case. But somehow, sensitively and appropriately, we can point to that which passes not, that which, you know, is here, was, is, and is to come. And I think to balance out that, listening to people and yet pointing to something more, I think is our task right now.
Thank you. You put it so beautifully. It's just sort of, it's almost like embodying the resurrection a bit for people and not ramming it down their throats. But, you know, I've got a friend, she's a retired bishop. She said what she found helpful yesterday. She put on, they've got, this is very unchurch Scotland, but big black vestments. She said they'd hardly ever been worn before because we don't do national mourning that often. Just once a year on a Remembrance Sunday, they wear them. So they're quite thick as well because it's winter in November. And she said there's something about putting on the black stiff robes. She felt like she was putting on the armor of God. You know, she's putting that kind of great St. Patrick's breastplate kind of thing. And wandering through the cathedral I'm lucky enough to live in, past the, there's no graves of kings, but there is the memory in that building of we've done this before and we've been there before, and going right back to Easter Sunday. And that in our being and in our welcome, which is countercultural at the moment, isn't, to be that radically open in our day and age is radical. It shouldn't be, but it is. I remember I moved from London when no one talks to each other. It's weird if you do, to a smaller place. And even I was like, well, this is weird. Why are people talking to me in shops? Like, what's going on? And then getting used to that. It's much more, we should be more connected in the community, but we've lost it, to have that radical openness now with armor on ourselves. Armor is a bit of a military metaphor, but you know, we live live and embody the hope of the resurrection of Jesus Christ into our communities right now can be such a powerfully healing presence for what we're going through.
I think so. And I love the word radical because it absolutely must define church. I mean, it was radical in the very beginning. I mean, Jesus embodied something that was a challenge to everything that was known, understood. And of course, we've allowed the church to be tamed, horribly tamed through the years when one of my colleagues in the Church of Scotland, he's a book out called Rewilding the Church. And, you know, I love that phrase, Steve Aisthorpe, rewilding the church. And that appeals to me. It really does. Think of a garden that's beautifully tended and everything's in neat rows and the colour schemes have been beautifully laid out. I mean, I can admire that, but I love to see something that's much wilder and more natural and just happens. So I'm really looking for church to be rewilded and radical, as you've spoken about. And gosh, if there's anything radical in the whole of human history, then it's resurrection.